Session number 18622, Reel 3.
Jim Brand, Reel 3.
We then started running from North Africa, delivering, and Sicily, delivering stuff to various parts of the, as the army advanced up each side. And in fact, on one occasion, the flotilla did, because the flotilla had broken up, we didn't have a full flotilla of our LSTs there. Some of them had been sent off to other places. In fact, the captains of the or the leaders of the various groups complained bitterly about it, why we didn't keep and maintain a flotilla system going all the time. A lot of the LST leaders, you know, the commanders in charge of the various flotillas, complained about that. Anyway, on this particular occasion, we had to go up to a place called Manfredonia, up on the Adriatic coast of Italy. And it was just a bit north. It was, in fact, just past the front line. We were just north of the front line of the, where the action was. And we were going to land troops in this Manfredonia. And as it happened, there was a jetty, a stone jetty there. It was just right for us to unload on. The ramp went straight down onto the jetty, and everything could run off onto this ramp. Anyway, we got there, and we arrived, and we had to spend the night on this jetty. And that was something new for me. Anyway, I was given a revolver and put on sentry duty that night for the first time. We left there the next morning at daybreak.
Were these British or American troops?
No, they were British troops. They were British troops. We then left there the next morning and went south, and we went into Barry. And the skipper gave 2 hours leave each watch in Barry. And then we left there. There were spotter planes came over while we were there, and we came out of there, and when we were about 10 miles south of Barry, there was an air raid on Barry Harbour when they sank that ammunition ship in the middle of Barry Harbour and just about decimated Barry altogether.
Did you see that?
No. We, as I said, we heard it, but we didn't see it. But we seemed to get more than our fair share of air attacks somehow. In fact, I started having nightmares about Stukas, which stopped as soon as we left the Med, or before it left the Med, that stopped. But I did for some time have every time, as soon as I'd fall asleep, I'd hear this screaming coming out the sky. But, of course, everybody wasn't the same. Other people didn't seem to take any notice of it. So we got through it all right. Anyway, the...
And the boat is still undamaged?
Yes, we never got hit at all. We were extremely lucky. In fact, we never had a ship... Nobody in our ship's company even got injured except one chap. What happened was that the ships themselves had orlicans. They had 6 orlicans, port and starboard bow orlicans, and one on each corner of the superstructure of the bridge. So there was port 1, 2, and 3, port starboard 1, 2, and 3 orlicans, twin barreled orlicans. And the ready use ammunition was kept in lockers around the sort of platform that the orlicans were in. They were at a steel ring around the orlican platform where the people that fired the orlican stood inside it to fire this thing. And the ammunition lockers were around the outside, so they only had to turn around, lift the ammunition lid, and take another reel of ammunition out and put it into the They had a wire that used to go up and around, so that the only, so the only, all they had to do to cock the thing was to put it, just to lift it up, and you know, but the action with the wire then pulled the bolt back and loaded the gun. But during the excitement, on one occasion, on the end of each gun they had a flash eliminator, a big long flash eliminator. And around each one of the gun, they had one of these webs of pipe, metal steel pipe, so that you couldn't track the gun around and hit the ship. Then the only thing that stopped them from doing that, of course, was this flash eliminator on the back, on the end of the muzzle, I mean. And the port, Oregon, in front, that number two port, Oregon, on the wings of the bridge, on the wing, port wing of the bridge, the flash eliminator got smashed. It either got hot and broken or something, and the chap didn't realize it in the heat of the moment. And he was tracking an aircraft while he was firing, and next thing you know, the shells were hitting the lid of the ammunition locker of the Oregon, the other side of the ship. But luckily, nobody got injured. They got away with that. That was all right. And that only ever happened once. But on another occasion, a chap in that same gun platform, in the starboard one on the wing of the bridge, a piece of shrapnel, just a small piece of shrapnel, about an half an inch long, and it must have been almost spent, hit him right between the eyes, just above the bridge of his nose. And embedded itself half in. He got hold of it and pulled it out himself with his fingers. And that was the only time we had anybody hit on board the ship itself. And that's the only one we had. In fact, he never even made anything of it. He went down to the sick bay and had a plaster put on it or something, and that was it. Anyway, we kept on running here, there, and everywhere, dropping off stores. On one occasion, we were sent to a place, not our Canadians that we brought out to the Med, but a Canadian tank outfit had been landed at a particular place on the west coast of Italy, if my memory serves me right, on the west coast of Italy. And where they'd been landed, there was no way out. There was no way these tanks could get out of it. They were completely surrounded by mountains, and there wasn't a road or a track wide enough for the tanks to get out of the place, and they'd been trapped there for about a month when we had to go back and pick them up. And by the time we went back to pick them up, half the tanks crews were going out with the local girls and all the rest of it. I think there was a couple of marriages that came out of that in the end. But then we picked them up and took them further up and dropped them again so that they could get into the wharf again. Then, of course, came January, and we had it all to do again at Anzio. The first day at Anzio wasn't too bad. We'd taken them a bit by surprise there. And we were there for the first day, and as it became daylight, we were there. And we could see everything happening on the beach. We were told to stay out until we were called in. And eventually we were called in to unload. And the steering gear broke down. Electric steering gear broke down. And we had to stop and go back out. That happened to us three times on the way into the beach at Salerno. And eventually we did get on the beach. And we landed and unloaded. We went back to Pozzuoli, which is a village just north of Naples, and loaded up again and came up again. And by the time we came back the second time, of course, the Germans had gathered in force, and the beachhead was now under constant and heavy fire all the time.
Who were you landing at Anzio?
Americans. We carried Americans to Anzio. I don't know, there must have been British as well, but we carried Americans, and we went on carrying Americans most of the time. Mostly American soft-skin vehicles after the initial landing, trucks and things. But we used to take trucks up loaded with gear. They would nip off and unload, and they'd try desperately to get back in time to get on board the ship again to be taken back for the next load. Of course, they didn't always make it, but they used to try to do that if they could. But everybody ran in convoy there. There was no ships going independently. Everything was still in convoy. And we used to have to lay off out in the bay. And we used to keep well separated, because up country a little way, they had this gun that was mounted on a train or something that used to run in and out of a mountain cave. It was nicknamed Anzio Annie. It must have been a massive gun, because the shell it fired was enormous. I mean, and that used to, every now and again, a shell would land in the bay, you know, and go off with a hell of a bang. It didn't hit any of the LSTs while I was there, anyway. I don't know if it did sink any of the other ships that were there, but it certainly kept life a bit hectic. You know, when you were there, you never knew what was going to happen. When we spent one night on the beach, alongside, there was a sort of jetty thing there, and we ran in next to it and opened the doors and dropped the ramp and unloaded, and then we had to stay there for the night. And after it got dark, I went out onto the upper deck, on the starboard side of the upper deck, and I'm stood there looking up, because there was an air raid or something going on. And then I saw, because we had a sort of mast thing on the LST, and I looked up and I could see this thing traveling. It looked like almost like a shooting star or something. And I watched it. It went straight over the top of the mast, a long way up, disappeared out to sea. And then there was an enormous crash out there. And that particular flying bomb sunk the HMS Spartan, the cruiser, brand new cruiser. I had the fortune to serve with a P.O. Jack Dusty that was serving on board the Spartan in later years. His name was John Pickford. We served together out the West Indies after the war finished. And John was very badly injured by that one. But anyway, then we went back to Pond. After about three trips, the supply officer came and said to me, Brent, he said, I want you to go ashore in Naples. And he said, when you get there, the supply officer in the base there has got a job for you to do. And they provided me with some lorries, real old lorries, solid tires, and really no business being on the road, but they were still in use. And I had to travel around the countryside picking up as much fresh vegetables as I could, brought it back to the base, and then deliver them the next day to the LSTs when they came into Potswally. And I did that job for about a fortnight. Then the ship came back, and I had a message to say, report to the ship at Potswally and bring your kit. I went back there, and we went back to North Africa, and then we left to come home.
Which was the worse, Anzio or Salerno?
For the landing itself, Salerno was worse, as far as we were concerned. But I believe the fighting ashore in Anzio was much worse. Much worse even than Salerno. Salerno was dreadful, mind. It was really bad, Salerno. But I understand that the fighting ashore, Sid Hook, who got the DSM at Salerno, told me, because he saw more of it than I did up there, and he told me one day, he said that it was really diabolical there. You know, he was there quite a bit, apparently, and he said it was terrible after a few days. What happened was that the Americans stopped about 10 miles off from the beach or something and set up a perimeter and didn't advance any further. The idea had been to take Rome, of course. And they stopped instead of carrying on.
But from your point of view, Salerno was worse than Anzio.
Oh, yes, I think so. Especially the landing. The day we landed, the actual invasion was much worse. It was fairly obvious that Salerno, they were sat there waiting for us. There was no two ways, there was no argument about that whatsoever.
So you said you set off back for England.
Well, we did, but first of all, they sent us, we went back to Ferryville, of course, to northern North Africa, and then we were sent empty to Casablanca. We went to Casablanca and we picked up a load of free French troops to bring back to UK for the D-Day landings. We got back from there and we landed at Port Talbot in South Wales.
What did you think of the Free French?
Oh, they were all right. Yes, they were good enough. I would never have any arguments about the Free French. They liked their coffee very strong, much stronger than we did. They seemed to boil it all night in one of the coppers, so that, as far as I was concerned, it was almost undrinkable, but they loved it. I think they got a bit upset because, their ration of wine was stopped while they were on the ship. But they didn't get the tot, though. They didn't get a tot. Thank goodness for that, too. I don't think we could have provided that lot with rum.
There were a lot of them.
There seemed to be, yes. A lot of them were sleeping in vehicles and things like that. And anyway, we landed at Port Talbot. In the meantime, our Commander Sutton, apparently he had a sort of a state somewhere in UK, and he was a big horse man himself in private life. And we went to Manfredonia on one occasion when we were out in the Med, and he bought himself a donkey ashore, which he brought on board. And we kept on board, and we bought sacks of dry beans and things like that that we used to feed this donkey. We rigged a sort of canvas dodger on the upper deck for this donkey to live in. And the first thing we did when we got to, once we got rid of the French troops in Port Talbot, a leading seaman by the name of Damerel, Cock Damerel, came from London, of course, being called Cock. Three badges, reservist, recalled for the war. And he was given the job of delivering the donkey to the captain's home. And it was incredible. I'd never seen anything like it. He went out over the ramp leading the donkey, and you can imagine what the people in Port Talbot Dockyard must have thought of that. I dread to think what somebody must have thought when they saw us bringing in the donkey in, but still, there we are. He did it. We were there for about a week. Then we went to Liverpool. We went into, by that time, Gladstone Docks had been taken over completely by the Navy, for escort duties and things like that. Captain Walker's mob used to use that place a lot. We were there for, I don't know, about 2 or 3 weeks, I suppose, altogether. Well, we just cleaned up the ship and looked after the thing, probably had some leave. And then we were sent from there around to Parkston Quay near...
Bournemouth.
Pardon?
Bournemouth.
No, in Norfolk. In Norfolk.
In Yarmouth.
It was near where the boys' training establishment used to be, Ganges.
Oh, Shotley.
Shotley, near there. Anyway, Parkston Quay. We were anchored off Parkston Quay, and we were there for a few days, and there was a hell of a lot of LSTs there, I remember. Anyway, we went away somewhere and we filled up with troops, came back and anchored again in Parkston Quay, and we sailed for there for D-Day. We left, our flotilla left to go to sea to land in France on the 5th of June. And we went out, and I don't know what happened, but everybody else was recalled and went back in. But our people didn't, for some reason or other, and I've never known why we did it. I've thought about it a lot afterwards. We went down, and and got into the channel, and we sort of steamed up and down the channel all night and all next day. And since then, I've had an idea that it might have been a decoy ploy to make them think we were going to land somewhere else. But I don't know for that for certain, but I've often thought that. But anyway, then eventually we joined up with the rest of them and we went across on the 6th of June. And the day we were going to sail from Parkeston Quay, the first lieutenant, who was a Canadian, sent for me and said, "Brent," I said, "I've got a job for you." He said, "I want this chap looked after until we get to the beach," he said, "and then he's to be put ashore." And he turned this little fellow over to me. He was a short, stocky built man, and he'd be in his 40s, dressed in a sailor's uniform with a kit bag and hammock. And he was no sailor. I mean, his uniform looked like somebody that had been joined the Navy today. You know, he was just wearing it. He wouldn't say anything. We didn't question him at all. He lived in my mess until we actually, and then we got over to France, as I say, and we were ready to go in just after daylight on the 6th of June. But we were told to anchor off, which we did. And we were still there that night. And after it got dark, the first lieutenant sent for me. He said, "That chap you've got in your mess," he said, "he's to be put ashore. An LCA is coming along for him now." He said, "Take him down and we'll open the ramp doors and lower the ramp down and he can go from the ramp into the LCA. So I said, "Yes, all right." But of course, the seas were running a bit by that time. And this chap was absolutely terrified. I've never seen a man so frightened in my life. One minute the LCA would be up almost above us, and the next minute it would be 12 feet below us. And you could see this chap wasn't going to jump. There was no way he was going to jump. So I threw his kit bag and hammock in and sung out to the chaps that were on board. I couldn't make out what, as I said, it was dark. I couldn't make out what they were. Anyway, they put all this gear together with something else, you know, to make up a soft sort of area. And as the LCA got almost up to us, I heaved this bloke in the middle of the back of my shoulder and knocked him in, and he fell in onto this stuff. And I never saw him again, but I never knew who he was. And I've wondered to this day what sort of job he had and who he was. No idea. Anyway, we on the 7th of June, first thing, as soon as it was daylight, we were called into the beach. And we landed, but of course, by the time we got there, this laughing and dancing was all over. They'd got in off the beach by then, so we had a fairly easy landing. Dry foot again, as far as our luck was concerned. We ran straight in on the beach, and they didn't even get their feet wet.
Which beach was this?
At Arromanches. I think it was Gold we landed at. Anyway, we sent them ashore, joined up a convoy and headed back to Southampton. On the way back, I saw my first doodlebug. We were in convoy. We were in the port line of the convoy, and in the starboard line of the convoy were quite a lot of American LSTs. And this doodlebug came over, and of course, everybody knew it had to be an enemy craft, because there was nothing like that. And the Americans opened up on this thing with everything. I've never seen so much ack being put up by, you know. Anyway, of course, they didn't touch it. But unfortunately, they tracked this damn thing across the sky. And the next thing you know, the shells are whistling across our deck. So that we felt a bit unhappy about that, but still nobody got hurt, as I said, so there we are. And we went back to Gosport. We loaded up again, and we immediately left. As soon as we got back and started to load up again, we were visited by a crowd of American journalists who wanted to know all about it. Of course, we couldn't tell them anything. We'd seen what, you know, the bit we'd seen. There had been an air attack in the night to the ships that were laying off, but we didn't get hit. I understand it was something got hit out there, but I can't remember what it was now. But the air, we expected the air to be thick with the German aircraft. We really expected this to be a humdinger, you know, worse than Salerno. But it didn't work out that way. There were very, very few German aircraft put in an appearance. And the minesweepers had done a wonderful job on clearing everything up, you know, the mines to leading into the beaches. They'd really done a first-class job. So, you know, life had been made easier for us anyway to get there. We went across and we ran backwards and forwards then for some time. I think about on the fourth trip over, we lined up and there was a chap on the beach with a big flag waving it to show us where to run into. And as we came in, there was an awful scrunch underneath the ship somewhere when we were about 100 or so yards off the beach, off the shore, the water line. And we carried on in anyway and unloaded, got everything, turned around and came out again. And just after we got outside, all the drinking water was salty. We'd found that what we'd done, we'd run over the top of a tank that had gone into the water and drowned. And the turret of the tank had ripped open the bottom of our ship from just under the bow right back through. Because the construction of the ship was such that, you know, there was a whole lot of tanks and things for ballast in that part of the ship. So that didn't really make a lot of difference. But anyway, we came back to ride and ran up on the beach, which is a very flat, sandy beach there. We ran up on the beach there, and when the tide went out, we tried to find out whether we could do anything about it ourselves, found that it was impossible. So we were directed to go up to Hull. When they repaired the ship up in Hull, we were there for about 10 days. They completely, you know, repaired this rip in the bottom, and then we went back to it again.
Any memories of staying at Hull?
I remember a pub there called the Blue Heaven that we used to get in. I don't know. It's still there, I believe. Some of our Hull members have told me that it's still there. But literally, no, not really.
What was so special about the Blue Heaven?
Well, we all used to get there, that's all. And the place, an enormous gin mill. You've never seen anything. It was an enormous place. I mean, it could have taken the main room was as big as two or three ballrooms, you know, at least if my memory's serving me right. But we had a lot of fun there. Because it was nearly all just drinking and singing and dancing, you know, there was nothing else.
Did you see anything of air raid damage at Hull?
Oh, yes. Well, of course, the city had been hammered, you know. The town itself had been hammered. But the one thing that I remember about Hull, I don't know why this stuck in my mind, but Hull was the only place in the country that had its own telephone system. It had it then, and it still got it. And I always remember that. But Hull was all right. You know, the people there were friendly, and we got on fine there. Then, as I said, we were repaired and we went back to it again, and we were running then fairly frequently until eventually.